Heights Desert in the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, in whatever time zone you may reside. All of them covered thoroughly indeed by this program, Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. It's great to be here, an honor to be with you on the weekend. This night, we will interview somebody that I've been dying to interview for, I don't know, 4 or 5 months at least. It was about 4 or 5 months ago that a total bombshell of a story broke on the news wires. It was on all the networks. You may remember it said a researcher has discovered that the Y chromosome, the male chromosome, is deteriorating. It's falling apart. And in another 100,000 years or whatever, there'll be no more of us guys. That's it. We're gone. No more men in the world. That is one researcher's view. His name is Brian Sykes, and we're going to have him on at in the next hour, 11 o'clock Pacific time. And I've got his book here. It's called Adam's Curse. That's an appropriate name for a book like that. Adam's Curse, huh? It is like a curse. Eventually, you are no more. I think he's down in Australia or somewhere like that. Let's see. I don't know, maybe Great Britain. I don't know. Anyway, he's far away somewhere, and we'll be calling him in the next hour. This hour, we'll have open lines and a few things that I've got that I want to run by you. News-wise, in a daring escape, an American hostage in Iraq, Thomas Hamill, just pried open the doors of the house where he was being held and walked out virtually into the arms of U.S. troops. And, you know, I had seen some video of this guy, Thomas Hamill, and I thought when I saw him, they had a shot, you may have seen it on CNN or something, of him in a car. And I thought, you know, he looks like CIA or Special Forces or something, but they say he was just an American, so, you know, I'm not saying he's CIA, I'm just saying he kind of had that look to him like he was one tough mama of a guy. Anyway, he walked right out, and he's now free. Not a good day in Iraq, there aren't many of those lately at all. Matter of fact, 11 Americans died at the hands of insurgents. Again, and the numbers are going up at an extremely concerning rate for the administration. And, of course, there was a big hoo-ha over the Nightline business the other night. And now the story about torture. Dia El-Shawahiri spent several stints in Baghdad's notorious prison. Twice under Saddam Hussein's rule, once under American, he prefers Saddam's torture to ours, I guess. Says he was stripped naked by American guards. Told the Associated Press all kinds of things were done to him. General Richard Myers said Sunday, on the other hand, there is no evidence of systematic abuse. And the actions of just a handful have unfairly tainted all American forces. Torture. You know, the Egyptians worshipped cats as great intellectual deities, as towers of intellectualism. The Egyptians really did think cats were very smart. Very intelligent. And, you know, there's only two mammals that torture. Humans and cats. You ever thought about that? Have you ever watched a cat with a mouse or anything else? I wonder if it is in our nature. There's a lot working on both sides. You know, they really hate us. The radical Islamics. They want us dead. They certainly proved that, didn't they? And a lot of Americans have a lot of very serious memories about September 11th, so you know, nobody ever endorses torture, you might understand those some of the emotions that the American captors may have gone through if there was some of that. Anyway, that's an interesting note and something for you to consider really hard, that only two mammals on Earth really torture, and that would be humans and cats. I'm not sure if that says a lot for us or a lot for cats or less for the two groups. For financially pressed consumers, it's coming down to a choice between spending on gasoline or groceries. What do you think they're choosing? Well, so far, gasoline is winning. This is from a food industry analysis. Given the economic environment, it is not surprising that more shoppers are buying food today in discount stores and other low-price venues than ever before. So they're spending their money where? On gasoline. But I guess that'll reach a balance at some point, won't it? We'll be right back. I thought this of possible interest to you. It certainly was me. Two crashes in a row, can you believe that? That happened last night, first time out of the chute each time. That's very interesting. What do you think would happen if E.T. arrived? Well, there's something actually known about that. Let me read you a little bit of this. It's a wonderful article by Jim Wilson, who I think wrote it for Popular Mechanics. I can't be sure about that. I think, yes, Popular Mechanics, probably the cover story. Within the scientific community, the question is no longer whether extraterrestrial life exists, but if E.T. is smart enough to do long division. Scientists are of two minds regarding the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence. Skeptics acknowledge simple life forms might be found on other planets, but insist intelligent life is unique to Earth. Their belief is based on the assumption that Earth possesses unique physical attributes, including a magnetic field that deflects cosmic rays and a moon that absorbs asteroids together. These protective features make Earth a rare, safe harbor. One that nurtured the evolution of primitive life forms into intelligent beings that, well, I won't say it. The opposing camp sees the prospect for discovering alien life in more mathematical terms. Its touchstone, the Drake equation, which links the probability of discovering extraterrestrial intelligence to factors such as the size of the universe, the number of stars, with Earth-like planets, with the discovery of each new planet beyond Earth's solar system, there are now more than 100, the odds of encountering intelligence increase. Governments and international organizations about the world have taken notice of the changing odds. No governmental official has gone on record yet claiming that UFOs are real, let alone a threat. Yet, with little public fanfare, check this out, folks, they have, in fact, begun preparing for the single most important event in human history, first contact. That is the moment Earthlings discover incontrovertible proof that they are not alone. Unless E.T. materializes from another dimension in the middle of the Super Bowl, humans most likely are going to have some advance warning of arrival. How much time we get to straighten up for extraterrestrial company depends on who spots E.T. first. The privately funded SETI Institute uses radio telescopes owned by observatories around the world to sweep the sky for signals broadcast by advanced civilizations. If E.T. has read Emily Post or her intergalactic equivalent and calls ahead, we could have years or decades or longer to prepare for first contact. Unfortunately, the current SETI Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Project can afford to look only at small swatches of the sky, so any extraterrestrial courtesy calls probably are going to be missed. In fact, a more likely scenario is that the U.S. Air Force would spot E.T. spacecraft as it traversed the void between Earth and the Moon using powerful radar and optical telescopes in Hawaii, Greenland, Florida, the Indian Ocean, The Air Force Space Command tracks satellites, monitors missile launches, and spots baseball and larger-sized bits of orbiting debris with the hope of preventing any accidents, of course. But in fact, if ET turns up on Space Command's radar, that would mean alien visitors are hours or perhaps even just minutes away. So, what would happen? The broad brush outline for Earth's response to the first alien encounter is set out in an international agreement called the Declaration of Principles Concerning Activities Following the Detection of Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Written by a committee of scientists organized by the SETI Institute, the declaration spells out what astronomers should do and what they should avoid doing immediately after first contact. Perhaps the most surprising, now you listen to me very carefully here, the most surprising aspect of the agreement is that astronomers who sign on to the declaration agree to keep the news of any imminent contact under their hat until the astronomy community and authorities have been notified. Now, how many times have you heard me interviewing Seth Shostak when he has said, "Oh, no! It would get out," and sure enough, in this article, they actually do cover that aspect that, you know, it might, the publicity might, it might break, somebody might leak it or something, but really, the fact of the matter is, and Seth has never told me this, they sign something that says, oh no, goes first to the other astronomers, then the authorities. Now, authorities would cover a whole lot of ground, wouldn't it? I'm not going to, I obviously have time to read all of this, and you should pick up a, you know, a copy of Popular Mechanics and read this very long article, but oh my, what would happen if they got here? The question of how humanity might react to its first contact with intelligent aliens was officially raised in the late 1950s by the then newly created National Aeronautics and Space Administration, our lovable NASA. Curious as to how discoveries about the origin of the universe might affect society as a whole, NASA contracted with, of course, the famous Brookings Institute. And I need not cover that because you know what Brookings has pretty much said, how it would upset the apple cart here on Earth and so forth. If ET turns up at NASA's doorstep bearing an invitation, you know, the one we sent out in a spacecraft, it's in for a bit of a surprise. Instead of getting a handshake from the head of NASA, wouldn't that be nice? It will instead be handcuffed by an FBI agent dressed in a biosafety level 4 suit. Instead of sleeping in the Lincoln bedroom, as you might expect at the White House, why, this alien will be whisked away to the Department of Agriculture's Animal Disease Center on Plum Island off the coast of New York, Long Island, where it will be poked and probed by doctors from the National Institutes of Health, a Department of Energy, or DOE, a Nuclear Emergency Search Team, NEST, a NEST team they're called, will tow away its spacecraft like it had parked by a hydrant. Unfriendly as this welcome may seem, it is the chain of events that would most likely follow any visitor's arrival. And there's so much more to this article, so I suggest you pick up a copy of Popular Mechanics, a kind of squashes the, you know, the concept of the cheering, welcoming crowds, the handshake from, well, yeah, you know, the head of NASA, then the president of the United States and other world leaders, and a cheery event. Oh, no, it's off to Plum Island and needles. Yay, yay. Oh, let's see. Oh, here's something else NASA's up to, maybe. In the First World War, frontline troops who were away from their loved ones for long periods famously had bromide put into their tea, which does roughly the opposite of a lot of what your email suggests those little pills do. In other words, it reduces the distraction of any females around. You just aren't interested. But yesterday it was suggested such measures might be taken a lot further, in fact, all the way to Mars. Dr. Rachel Armstrong, speaking yesterday at a British Interplanetary Society symposium on the on human future in space, said that the U.S. space agency NASA was considering how to deal with the natural urges of astronauts traveling on long journeys, such as a 3-year trip to Mars, where the 6-strong crew would likely be including 2 women. NASA's talking about the chemical sterilization of astronauts on longer journeys. I don't know. NASA was nonplussed by the suggestion yesterday. I haven't heard anything about it, said a spokesman at NASA's Johnson Space Center, where the long-range trips announced by our president in January are now being planned. But the denial may hide a reluctance in a nation like ours, where the showing of a nipple on national television, oh, what that did. There was religious outcry. There was FCC action. I mean, we're not exactly Victorian, but we're not exactly that far away from it either. So NASA doesn't even like to talk about stuff like this. But I guess it could be an issue, right? I mean, you've got several men up there with the right stuff. And women, and they've got a long journey to make. I mean, what, 18 months possibly? Or even if it got down to 6 months there and 6 months back, that's still a long, long journey. Well, maybe this is our future. Florida. It's Manalapan or something like that, Florida. Associated Press, one of the nation's wealthiest towns, is soon going to have cameras and computers running background checks on every single car and driver that passes through. The police chief there, a fellow named Clay Walker, said cameras are going to take infrared photos, recording a car's tag number. Then software will automatically run the numbers through law enforcement databases. A 911 dispatcher is alerted should car be stolen or is the subject of a be on the lookout for kind of warning. Next to the tag number, police will have a picture of the driver, taken with another set of cameras, upgraded versions of the standard surveillance cameras already in place, but this baby will nail your face. And if there's a robbery, police will be able to comb records to determine who drove through town on any given afternoon or evening. In other words, let's see, courts have ruled that in a public area, you have no expectation of privacy, said Walker, one of 11 sworn officers who protects that town's 321 residents. Still, Walker says their data will be destroyed every 3 months. The town council authorized $60,000 in security upgrades last week after 3 burglaries this winter robbed residents of $400,000 in jewelry. Oh, it is a rich town. The town averages 2 or 3 burglaries per year, and residents demanded something happen fast, and this is what they're doing. So there's going to be cameras literally everywhere. You would not be able to go through this town without them having a picture of your car, your license plate, and your face. And I remember, you know, just a couple of years ago, going to the Super Bowl, and I was the unwitting guinea pig, along with everybody else who went to that Super Bowl, of the nation's first large mass attempt at taking everybody's picture. And they had computers there, and they were looking for felons. Now, nobody, as far as I know, was arrested. You know, nobody got arrested, actually, because of that. Even if the alarm bells went off and all the rest of it, it was merely an experiment to see if they could reasonably do it. And I think that what we're seeing here in this story is the perfection or the near perfection of this system. So I guess Big Brother is just about here. It's just about Orwell time, folks. When they can point a camera at you in your car and they can know everything about you in a couple of seconds flat, there's nowhere to run. Even though this would be a very large country, I suppose there was a day in America where, by golly, if you had to be on the lam, you could take off. But I think that day is ending. And I think now we can look forward to the probability, the certainty, the vast certainty that that George is out there winking at us right now. And that privacy, such as we knew it, is no more. That's right. They're everywhere. And nobody's going to go on the lam. Not if somebody wants to find you. Very, very different America, isn't it? From the high desert in the middle of the night, which is where we do our work and our play, this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born.
With Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
That would be me. Good evening, good morning, whatever. It's great to be with you, everybody. We're in open lines. Anything you want to talk about is fair game. Unscreened, untouched, unanswered until we get to them. That's what it is. No net. Coming right up. Stay right there. That's fast service. Look at this. I got a fast blast from Lex, who's the webmaster. Lex Loonhood. Hey, Art, I found that Popular Mechanics article you were reading from and have it posted first under the Hot Stories section, lower right side of the page. That's fast. All right, east of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi. That didn't work too well. Let me try it again. East of the Rockies, hello, you're on the air.
This is Bob.
Hello, Bob.
I believe that if your ice age descends on Europe, as you've predicted, that the Mediterranean could become a freshwater lake, Iraq could become the Eden garden, and North Africa could become the breadbasket of the whole portion of that world.
That's how it might work, Bob.
Can you imagine Iraqis having the remaining reservoir of oil and fresh water? They'd be the richest people in the world.
Well, I don't know. We occupy it, so maybe we'd be. I mean,
maybe our people went over there smarter than I think they are.
Maybe, Bob. I've got, you know, I want to say it again. Rush really just went off in a tangent about the movie. The movie. I'm going to tell you a couple things about the movie. It's going to grab you, and it's going to grab you from the first second you sit down, and it's not going to let you go. It's called The Day After Tomorrow. It's coming up. You may have begun to see some trailers for it now. They're running on television and in movie theaters and that sort of thing. It's going to be a big movie. And a rush, you know, took off really hard on it. I mean, you know, he said basically it was an issue nobody cared about. That just isn't true. Of all the things he said, to have said that, you know, it's an issue people don't care about, our climate or climate change or all the rest of that, but people don't care about it? Oh, my goodness, that's just not true. Anyway, this movie is going to be quite something, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to grab you really, really hard. Roland Emmerich's done a lot of work, and it's going to be something. It's called The Day After Tomorrow, coming up May 28th, nationwide. It's from our book. I say our book, Whitley Strieber, myself, Art Bell. It's called The Coming Global Superstorm, and The Day After Tomorrow is based in part on that book. And for those of you that have read both, you will see both books, or that book, of course, throughout the movie. And I warn you, it's one of those movies that is going to leave you absolutely breathless. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Art.
Hi.
How are you doing tonight?
I'm just spiffy, thank you.
Good to talk to you. I'm Dennis. I'm in Phoenix.
Hey, Dennis.
What I called about is kind of related to that, except it's more has to do with catastrophic earth changes. By the way, I'm looking forward to the movie. I'm rereading Coming Global Superstorm.
Mm-hmm.
But this evening I was watching part of, this was on cable, it's called 10.5 or 10.5.
Ah, yes. Now, be careful what you tell me here, because I have it on hard drive. I detest having to wait. And so instead I taped, put on hard drive tonight and will tomorrow night and then watch it all together.
Oh, what I have to say won't ruin anything for you.
Okay.
Who is it that, he's been a regular guest, the geologist from California who has learned to predict quakes, and he was actually even suspended.
He was the county mm-hmm. geologist, right, for mm-hmm. up in the Bay Area. It'll hit me. Anyway, I know who you're talking about, yes?
Yeah, anyway, the movie kind of has to do with some kind of visionary or farsighted geologist there in California who they pretty much get treated the same way. They must have been, whoever wrote that must have been paying attention to your program or him.
Huh.
Because those with the foresight pretty much get treated the same way, same reaction.
Yes.
And
yes,
well,
messengers are always shot.
Oh, and the politics and all that stuff, yeah.
They're always shot. Messengers
yeah.
are always shot. If it's bad news, people don't want to hear bad news. And that's all there is. Well, it's a funny thing. Actually, in a way they do, and in a way they don't. It's kind of like going to a horror movie. You know, why do you mm-hmm. go to a horror movie? It's going to scare you. You know it's going to scare you, but
oh, yeah.
you want that a little.
The thing is to have to live through it, and I suspect, I strongly believe, I have my reasons, I won't get into them, but and I was talking to somebody from California today who's moved here, and actually I don't think Phoenix is a safe place. I've got my reasons for that. I won't belabor this conversation, but he said, you know, we're due for a cleaning, and you know, the human race, or at least this country. And I says, well, you know, if the populace doesn't do it, I suspect actually Mother Nature will do it before the populace does.
Well, here's the thing about Mother Nature. Mother Nature, kind of like with justice, is you could think of her, you know, holding a couple of weights, right? And he's right about that. Mother Nature doesn't get angry. Mother Nature doesn't get mad. Mother Nature gets even. Is a sort of a way to think about it. And in other words, if something becomes too far out of balance, then inevitably there's something in nature that will act to correct that balance. Simple as that. A wild card line, you're on the air. Hello.
Good evening, Art.
Good evening to you.
Well, this is Pat. I'm calling you from Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And Art, do you know how the conventional wisdom is that if extraterrestrial life were proven to absolutely exist, that the Christian community would be shaken the most?
No, actually, that's not conventional wisdom, if you're drawing from what Brookings said. They suggested that, as unlikely as it might seem, the greatest disturbance would come to science.
To the scientific community.
Yes, indeed.
But I just wanted to relate something that I heard several years ago. I was listening to an interview on public television with the Reverend Billy Graham.
Ah, yes.
And in the middle of the interview, out of the blue, he makes a reference to the inhabitants of other planets. And the interviewer now picks him up on this. And, Art, I was astonished to hear Dr. Graham say that he believes absolutely that extraterrestrials are real and that there are many inhabited planets in our universe.
That is very interesting. I wasn't aware he had said that, but that's fascinating. Fascinating. And what was his general consensus?
If I can remember the context correctly, Art.
They're all God's creatures?
Yes, and that they might be human and some might not.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, he believes that they exist with... And he spoke it as an absolute, not as a theory.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. I would love to read a transcript of what the Reverend Graham said. I really would. I'd love to read that. Somebody out there inevitably will have it. And by the way, if you want to get something to me, it's not that hard. I am reachable. And I will give you a little hint. Because anybody who gets as many emails, and my emails number in the thousands, many days into the thousands, try and put something in the header that will suggest to me what it's about and how urgent it really is. Because I do a kind of, you know, when you get thousands of emails, it's kind of a system of triage. And without a header that would attract, then I'm liable to skip over it and regard it as, you know, another little blue pill advertisement. So try and put something in there. You can reach me, Art Bell at mindspring.com. That's ARTBELL at mindspring.com or Art Bell at AOL.com. Either one of those will get me. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, this is Fred calling from Portland, listening to you on WGAN.
Yes, sir.
I was just actually calling about, you had a few guests on there before talking about the speed of gravity.
Oh, yes.
And some that thought it was instantaneous, and other ones had other speculation about it.
Yes.
And I was actually just calling to say they did a study on that not too long ago involving Jupiter and quasars and things along that line.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientists were actually able to determine that it works at the speed of light.
They were?
Yes. There are several studies. If you go to google.com, it says the exact thing that they did.
That's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. At the speed of light. Confirming again, then, I suppose, that nothing can exceed the speed of light. Or at least supporting that, huh?
Yes. They said if the sun were to immediately just disappear, we'd still follow a trajectory for about 8.3 minutes, at which point we'd fly off at the tangent. There were some studies on it, and they had all the exact information, but...
So we'd have a real hot 8 minutes.
Yes.
So to speak. All right. Well, I appreciate the information, and I'll do a little bit of research on it.
Right, have a good night.
You too. The speed of gravity. Some guests thought it to be instantaneous, and I thought, well, then, how would you ever prove that it was not so? Because all matter is presently in existence, and to measure the speed of gravity, which relates to the mass of an object, you would have to create a new mass and then measure its effect from point A to point B, right? So I still have questions. A wild card line, you're on the air. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
Hello. Are we on the air now?
What's your best guess?
Okay. a few weeks ago, you had a conversation with Sir Charles.
Oh, yes.
Regarding the use of satellites to project microwave energy to the Earth.
Yes, sir.
For
energy, yes.
Right, right. Well, I was thinking that that system might be used to power up or to work to help to power up a space plane, as it were. If you had two satellites bracketing the plane on its line of flight, upwards, and you had the receiver dishes on port and starboard side in the fuselage.
Mm-hmm.
You know the SRBs from the...
In other words, you're suggesting that a satellite collecting energy, instead of beaming it... slow down. Instead of beaming it back toward Earth, could project it in a beam to a spacecraft that would then accelerate away from Earth, continuing to use this energy to build its acceleration.
Right, exactly.
Gotcha.
The SRBs from the shuttle, the solid rocket boosters...
Right.
They burn powdered aluminum, and the method of their ignition is like an arc welding type mechanism.
Yes.
So I was reasoning that perhaps, you know, the more voltage you had at hand, the less powdered aluminum you would burn, and consequently the greater distance you could cover.
Well, that's fascinating. I appreciate the call, and I wonder if we might not look into that a little bit. I wonder if NASA's looked into it. It's really an intriguing idea. He was talking first of the concept of beaming energy back to Earth, collecting it with large solar collectors in some sort of a fixed orbit, and then beaming them back to Earth, you know, with collectors on the ground. Instead, he is suggesting this as a means of propulsion, virtually of propulsion, of pushing a craft away from Earth, an intriguing idea, and perhaps a way with enough energy to accelerate to very great speeds. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello, Art.
Hello.
This is Experiment 626 again. How you doing?
why would you call yourself an experiment?
Well, like when I talked to you the last time with John Lear on the phone, but, oh, how we're all experimenting, and we're just vessels. And
yes.
Yeah, so anyway, did you see the latest headlines about the robots that they want to build for to send to the moon and to fix the space shuttle or the space...
the telescope?
Yeah.
The Hubble? Yes. Oh, yes, I did see that.
You know, they used that, Segway?
Yes.
The bottom of the Segway for the part of the robot.
Really?
Yeah, they got it showing a picture of it here, and it looks like, I don't know, looks like a, they call it a robo-knot.
Robo-robo-knot, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. It looks like a robot with a base like the Segway.
Well, they've got a lot of work to do with robots to get them really, really where we expect. You know, robots by now, we're supposed to be doing everything for us. The dishes, everything, and it just hasn't happened. It's very disappointing.
Just like you, I've been waiting for that. And it was, wait a minute, weren't we promised that back in 2000?
We sure were. Well, we were promised that back in the 50s.
Yeah, of course. You grew up in the same era I did.
Come on,
I want my jetpack, I want my flying car, and I want my robot.
You got it. That's right. Where are the flying cars?
Exactly. I'm going like, come on, this is supposed to be back to future time already.
Extremely disappointing.
Well, you have a good night, Art.
You too, sir. Take care. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
This is Olin in Culver City, California.
Yes, Olin.
Yes, the reason that Red China is underselling everybody since 1995 is because Red China is giving away 8.27 yuan per dollar when the dollar is only worth about 5 yuans. Red China is using slave labor to build up their military-industrial complex.
You mean kind of like we did?
Well, but they're in continuing violation of the GATT Treaty, which says...
All right, well, you know what, though? I think a lot of nations in their... infancy have used what amounts to slave labor, one way or the other. You can think of it that way.
Oh, I see.
Well, don't you think? I mean, really, America did some of that. We did have slavery, didn't we?
Well, yes.
And then that slavery built a lot of early America, didn't it?
Well, they also had indentured servants from Great Britain and Europe. So
I'm just saying it kind of it's one of those evolutionary things that it's not laudable, but it seems to be just almost universally true.
Well, selling low to get started is a good practice, but unfortunately we are under fascist economic attack to deindustrialize America and bankrupt the American government.
Yeah, that was last night's guest, and he makes point that we're pretty much on the way toward that now, huh?
Well, that's right. When Red China sells out the treasury bonds and notes that they're holding, they'll bankrupt the American government. As a matter of fact, Red China is dumping cheap foreign goods made by slave labor in concentration camps all over the world, dropping their goods all over the world.
Yeah, I know. I know.
So,
I don't know exactly what to do about it. I mean, jobs are being outsourced. You know, a lot of times when you call for tech support or something these days, it's incredible. It's like you'll get some guy and you'll notice an accent and, you know, maybe halfway through the conversation that you're straining to have, you'll say, hey, where are you? Oh, Bangladesh.
Yeah, well, I think I
guess. Pakistan. India.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what's going on.
Well, the problem here is that we're being deindustrialized by a fascist dictatorship with slave labor. And when they lower the boom by dropping that 8.27 wons per dollar and let the yuan float, mm-hmm. which they're supposed to do according to the GATT Treaty, why, then the value of the dollar will drop and the prices of all our goods and services will go up because things won't be that cheap anymore.
Yeah, you're right. It's going to be a rough ride. We have a tough economic ride ahead of us. And if you listen carefully, again, you know, messengers are shot, at least metaphorically. I mean, last night's guest kind of painted a fairly dismal picture of our current economic situation with regard to our place in the world right now and what's going on around us. Fairly dismal. And speaking of dismal pictures, just wait till you hear what's coming up next. Dr. Brian Sykes, who's one of the world's, and I really mean this, the world's foremost geneticists, is going to be with us. And he contends that it's later than you think, guys. Well, actually, it's later than you think for guys. In other words, eventually, there will be no more men. That's it. We're done. The Y chromosome is crumbling. And that's what makes men. From the high deserts, stay right where you are, because we'll be right back.
One interview changed the...
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
What a title. The book is Adam's Curse, A Future Without Men. I'll tell you an interesting story about this in a moment. Professor Brian Sykes, professor of human genetics at the University of Oxford, is one of the world's leading geneticists. After undertaking medical research into the causes of inherited bone disease, He discovered DNA could survive in ancient bones, and he was the first to report on the recovery of ancient DNA from archaeological bones in the journal Nature in 1989. Since then, Professor Sykes has been called in as the leading international authority to examine several high-profile cases, such as the Iceman, Chatterman, and the many individuals claiming to be members of the Russian royal family. Remember that controversy? Professor Sykes and his research team have, over the last decade, compiled the most complete DNA family tree of our species yet available. They are the founders of Oxford Ancestors Limited, the world's leading provider of DNA-based services for use in personal ancestry research. Now, Adam's Curse, of course, is, well, you may remember, it was several months ago, I absolutely went over the top when I read it. It was a newsflash that went around the world that Professor Sykes had discovered that the Y chromosome was deteriorating and that a literal truth might be that in 100,000 years, or whatever the figure was, I can't recall now, in all the AP and UPI reports, a man would cease to exist. Cease to exist. There would be no more men in the world. And it really caught my attention. I said, we have got to find Professor Sykes. Well, it was a long journey indeed, but we have found him. And in such an unlikely place. The phone number I called here a little while ago was 01144, and then the rest of the number, and 44 is a designator for England, so I was sure I was calling Great Britain, and sure enough, it rang. There was a long wait, and then it rang, and then I got a very cellular-type answer on the other end of the line, and there was Professor Sykes, and I said, oh, gosh, no, it's a bad connection, you know, transatlantic wait and all that. He said, well, why don't you call me here at the local number? And I said, okay, what's that? And he reels off an area code 206. So Professor Sykes is currently in the country. He's actually in the Seattle area somewhere, 206. And here I had called a transatlantic. It would bounce there and bounce back. And he was actually in Seattle. A wonderful surprise. So coming up from Seattle in a moment, Professor Brian Sykes. Professor Sykes, it is an honor to have you on the program.
Well, it's a great pleasure for me to be on that part.
Peace long.
Well, I'm over here in America because the U.S. edition of Adam's Curse just published last week. So that's the fortunate reason that you're able to call me really just down the road rather than across the Atlantic and Pacific or wherever it was.
I see. Wonderful. I have a copy of the hardback book here. It is a beautiful book, by the way. Very well done.
It's a nice color, isn't it?
It is indeed. And so you should be very proud of it. And is this the first book of this magnitude that you have published?
I wrote another book a couple of years ago, called The Seven Daughters of Eve, and you can see there's a connection between the two, that one being mostly about the history of women, or at least what DNA tells us about the history of women, whereas this one, Adam's Curse, as well as being about the extinction of men, is about what my research has discovered about the history of men.
Well, I'm sure we'll somehow get to all of that.
I'm sure we will. We've got plenty of time.
We sure do. That's the beauty of radio. It really is. Long-form radio. There's nothing in the world like it. It is a shocking claim, you know, that human males... are you sure when they talk to you about publishing and perishing, you didn't interpret it to mean publish about perish? No, huh?
It is a long time in the future.
Well, how long?
Well, I mean, if we start talking about that, we're going to be talking about the end of the book before we go through all the arguments.
Okay. All right. So just, I mean,
we'll get to it. I'm sure we'll get to it before the program finishes. But I think it's a process which, for reasons we'll have loads of time to go into, is inevitable. But the time scale, whenever you say something will happen, and you're going to be asked, well, when? So I've made various assumptions and come up with a figure about 5,000 generations from now, which is around about 100, 125,000, maybe 150,000 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm. How is this going to happen, Professor, and through what means were you able to discern this?
Well, why don't we talk about the rest of the book and we'll come to that, because it really is at the end of it.
Oh, all right.
Because if I answer that question straight away, it would take me about 20 minutes to get through the
No, that's just fine. So then why don't we ask you instead, then you're saying that basically we're only genetically modified women anyway. What do you mean by that?
Yep. Well, I think that there's not actually all that much dispute about that. I mean, the motive for writing Adam's Curse was because I wanted to try and sort of bring out the genetic reasons behind and the consequences of the fact that something that's perfectly blindingly obvious to everybody and it actually affects every single day, which is that our species, unlike every species actually, is divided into males and females. And well, you know, we could talk an entire program about the repercussions of that in our everyday sort of social encounters.
Professor, is the ratio roughly exactly 50-50?
Not quite, actually. There's, at birth, there's slightly more males born, but they're always rather a bit weaker.
Hmm.
And they don't live as long, of course. Men die before women. And I think there's a genetic reason underlying that. So let me just start off with this genetically modified women business. Well, it is the case that there's a little chromosome which men have and women don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And on that chromosome is one particular gene. And what it does is it flips a genetic switch. When we were only 6 weeks after fertilization, so very soon after we were conceived,
mm-hmm.
And this switch flicks and it ignites a whole relay of genetic reactions which take us away from what we otherwise would have become, which is girls. And it takes us away from that.
Really?
And bit by bit turns us into boys.
Really?
Yeah.
And is it a matter of chance with regard to that switch? In other words, could it as easily not be thrown as thrown?
Well, it's usually thrown. If people have a Y chromosome, if fetuses have a Y chromosome, they almost always end up as males. But occasionally, and this is how we know about how this works, occasionally there's something wrong with this switch, and it doesn't get thrown.
And then?
In that case, the natural course of events continues, and those children, those babies are born female, even though they've actually got a Y chromosome. So that's how we know that the Y chromosome is right at the heart of the matter, and that if it's not working, then the natural progression, it's not that if the Y chromosome isn't working, the fetus dies, or the embryo dies, it doesn't.
It
carries on and becomes female.
Fully, functionally, normal female. Is that true?
Pretty much, but for a complicated sort of chromosomal reason, they're usually sterile. But often very beautiful, as a matter of fact. So these are XY females, and there's a number of them actually made a career in modeling, believe it or not.
How rare are they, Professor?
Hmm?
How rare are they?
There's about one in between 1 in 5 and 1 in 10,000 a birth, something like that. So, you know, not exceptionally rare.
Really?
Yeah.
Certainly more common than I. In fact, you're telling me something new altogether. Well, then this might be the right place for Arlene's question. She sent one in by email before you got here, and I thought it was pretty good.
Uh-huh.
She asks, my theory is, maybe as the Y chromosome deteriorates, so do the actual resultant transitory human individuals. Therefore, we begin to see increasing numbers of homosexuals. Is it possible that homosexuality is merely an expression of the Y chromosome being in an in-between stage?
Well, it's a very good question. And I do, there's a chapter in Adam's Curse about homosexuality, but I think it's a bit more subtle than that, actually. That although the Y chromosome is deteriorating slowly, and we can go into how slowly and what the reasons for that are, I'm not myself convinced that it's that which is the cause of at least male homosexuality. Now, I don't really know whether homosexuality is increasing or decreasing, but when I've talked about Adam's Curse, I've had many many people say, well, you know, in my experience, in my neighborhood, then male homosexuality is increasing. Hmm. But I can't say that it's due, in response to Arlene's question, that it's clearly due to some changes in the Y chromosome. But we may get on to at some time what I think may be behind or maybe a cause of male homosexuality. But it's a very subtle one.
Okay. But you don't necessarily see a connection, is what you're saying?
I don't necessarily see a connection between between the Y chromosome and male homosexuality. But as I'm sure we'll get on to, the Y chromosome is actually involved in a very bitter genetic war with the Y chromosome being transmitted from father to son. If you like, a sort of proxy for the history and the history of the male sex, and certainly because it can only go from one generation to the next through the male sex and not through the female sex, because it's transmitted from father to son.
Yes.
It's completely opposed to another gene called mitochondrial DNA, which I wrote about in my first book, The Seven Daughters of Eve, which is passed from down the female line. So here you have two, if you like, warring genes that will never make peace.
Hmm. You actually describe a Y chromosome as a genetic ruin, a wasteland littered with molecular wreckage, a graveyard of rotting genes. Oh gosh, that sounds terrible. Is that really?
It does.
Yes. Is that a fair description?
Well, I mean, now we are able to look at detail in what the Y chromosome looks like. It's it certainly is in a bit of a mess. It used to, you know, years ago, millions of years ago, In our mammalian ancestors, the Y chromosome started off as an X chromosome, almost certainly, with thousands of different genes on it, and over a period of millions of years, lost most of those genes, only has 27 left now. And in between those genes, which are...
Oh, we're starting to pick up a little hum. Can you hear it there on the telephone?
I can, yes.
Yeah.
It's not coming from mine as far as I can.
You might just move that phone around or the wire around a little bit and see if it comes and goes. Anyway, the Y chromosome is under constant attack, you said, virtually at war, and I guess the presumption is it is over time going to lose the war.
It will lose the war, yes. It'll lose the war because it is deteriorating. And mutations are accumulating at quite a fast rate. And it is a common cause, these mutations on the Y chromosome, a common cause of male infertility these days.
Mm.
And the calculations, the estimates, if you like, of how long I think that the Y chromosome has left is based on the, what we see now as the mutations in that chromosome that are causing male infertility.
Professor, if it's 100 or 125,000 years out, whatever that eventually turns out to be, there's going to be a time between now and then where there are increasing numbers of...
infertile men.
Really?
Yeah.
I heard some sort of startling statistics about that, not very long ago. It's already starting to happen now, isn't it?
Sure. I mean, it is. I mean, 7% of men are not completely infertile, but they're subfertile. That's a very high percentage.
Did you say 7%?
7%.
7%, all right.
7% of men. And of those, between 1 and 2%, that's not of the 7%, but between 1 and 2% of men are, their infertility, or subfertility, if you like, is caused by mutations on the Y chromosome. So that's very, very high. And because, clearly, their fathers could not have been infertile, these must be new mutations that are happening, or many of them new mutations that are happening in these men themselves. So it's very startling.
Well, that is startling. And is it going to be a linear deterioration, or will the process at some point go through a sudden acceleration, or between now and 100 or 125,000 years, is it going to be linear, more and more and more infertile men?
Yes, I think so. I think it will. If Y chromosomes are completely rendered completely infertile by mutation, then they won't get further because they clearly won't have any sons. But there are mutations which reduce fertility, and those are the ones that will get through to the next generation but will produce males that are less fertile than their fathers, and that's the accumulated effect which I believe will mean that in that sort of time frame that we've been talking about, that fertility will decrease to a level of about 1% of what it is now. And when that point is reached, I'd call that a day for the Y chromosome.
Those are going to be a very popular 1%, aren't they? And there's going to be a lot of time.
I don't know. They're going to be, there's going to be men around, but they're going to be very infertile.
I'm just trying to find some little bright side to this somewhere.
It's not necessarily, I mean, there are things we can do about it, I think. But
this is
a process that, this is one of the features of the Y chromosome, which, I mean, in the book, which is, we are really talking about the end of the book now, rather than the rest of it, but in the book, because my main research has been looking at what the Y chromosome can tell us about the history, our own human history and the history of men, it's clear from my research and those other people that some Y chromosomes have done remarkably well, and those are Y chromosomes that have been associated with extremely unsavory historical figures a lot.
Really?
Oh, yeah. So the most extreme example, which I've come across, work done by some other Oxford scientists, was to track down the Y chromosome of Genghis Khan, the Mongol emperor.
Of course.
Now, Genghis Khan lived in the 12th century, and work in Central Asia has shown that 16 million men are his direct descendants, so they have his Y chromosome.
And a great big bold capital Y, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Professor, hold on. We're already at the bottom of the hour, and so we'll take a bit of a break here. Genghis Khan, I suppose, huh? And even the bad guys, the Hitlers of the world, the ruthless dictators of the world, great big capital Ys. You're going to learn a lot tonight, so am I, I'm sure. Professor Brian Sykes, author of a brand new book that you're going to want to check out. It's called Adam's Curse. From the high desert, middle of the night, I'm Art Bell.
To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
And what a guest we've got. Professor of Human Genetics at the University of Oxford, Professor Brian Sykes is our guest. He's saying that another 100,000 years or so, there will be no more men because the Y chromosome is virtually, well, it's tattering itself. It's falling apart. It's a genetic mess. We'll be right back. Believe we were last talking about Genghis Khan and so forth, and they've got the big capital Ys. I guess that would apply to the Hitlers and the big bad, rough, ruthless dictators in the world and generally violent people. Am I on the right track there?
Well, what distinguishes, let me ask you a question, what distinguishes all those types of people?
Testosterone, I guess.
They're all men, aren't they?
Testosterone, yeah.
They're all men. And in Adam's Curse, I developed the idea that, well, I'm not necessarily causing it, the Y chromosome really, of these men, really benefits from their bad behavior. So It's a sort of moot point about which is driving... which was Genghis Khan driving his Y chromosome to great success, or look at it the other way, was it Genghis Khan's Y chromosome that was actually driving him to do the things he did? And what did he do? Well, he started the largest land empire ever known, the Mongol Empire.
Mm-hmm.
He invaded adjoining countries. He invaded. I mean, he had a fantastic army.
Mm.
He killed all the men, and he brought the women along, or had them brought along, and he inseminated all the women one by one.
Mm.
And that's how his Y chromosome spread.
Mm-hmm. That's why he has produced so many capital Ys as descendants.
Right.
That's very interesting.
And it's a obvious tendency of people, especially in times gone by, maybe, and different parts of the world now, men who have a lot of power and wealth and status,
mm-hmm.
not all of them, but more than most men,
mm-hmm.
do tend, when they can, to accumulate large numbers of women.
Mm-hmm.
And there's fantastic numbers of tens of thousands of concubines, for example, that were kept for the exclusive use of some well-attested historical despots or emperors. So the two things are very much interlinked.
But there would be another side to that, Professor, wouldn't there? And that would be that some of the greatest achievements were testosterone-driven as well. I mean, some of mankind's greatest achievements, indeed.
Well, that's right. That's right. So you're absolutely right. The fact that we exist as two sexes, male and female, has driven our evolution, particularly, I think, in the last 10,000 years, and we may go into the reason why it's in the last 10,000 years, and it has driven very many aspects of our evolution. And that works by a type of evolution. It's not natural selection, which is the one that... Darwin is best known for, but mm-hmm. another of his theories, which is sexual selection. And it's not usually been appreciated that sexual selection is going on in our own species, but well known in others. So perhaps the most familiar example is the the peacock's tail. Now, male peacocks have a huge and elaborate tail, very colorful, very, to us, very beautiful. And the peahens, the female peacocks, are, by comparison, dull and well camouflaged. Now, what's driven the male peacock to become like that? It's been a slow evolution of male peacocks growing a tail, then one will have a slightly better tail and will attract more mates, and therefore his genes will pass on preferentially to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the tail gets bigger and bigger. But it's also driven not just by men growing bigger, by male peacocks growing bigger tails, but by the male peacocks, their evolution, the evolution of their tail being driven by the choice of the peahens, because they must be able to appreciate these tails for that evolution to occur. So it's a cycle of sexual selection, and it can happen and transform a species very, very quickly.
Well, that is a sort of natural selection, though, isn't it?
It's natural, yes, but Darwin was careful to distinguish the two. It's certainly natural, but it's not. It's not as if, you know, our evolution, the reason I'm talking about the peacock is because I see parallels there between what's happened in the peacock and the evolution of our own species over the last 10,000 years, which has been extraordinarily rapid, hugely rapid. I mean, we don't appreciate that necessarily because we live in, you know, we're actually in this modern world, but it's been extremely fast.
Quite right.
And why is that? Well, the idea that I advance in Adam's curse is that men use wealth and power and status in the same way that peacocks use their tails.
Evolved in the
parallel fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And why didn't they evolve before? It's because there were no such things as wealth and property and ownership before the invention of agriculture. Agriculture comes along, then land becomes owned, flocks of domestic animals become owned, wealth begins to accumulate. Prior to that, we were really struggling to make a living anywhere, just wandering around as hunter-gatherers by and large in small bands. We didn't have any property. We didn't have anything to own. So we couldn't, that couldn't be factored into the ever-present possibilities for sexual selection.
Hmm. Well, why then, given the state of the world today, aren't the Donald Trumps of the world just putting lots of capital Ys out there?
Well, they probably are.
Ah.
They probably are.
Then
they
why?
They certainly have been. They certainly have been in the past, and that's how, because my research team has been looking at Y chromosomes distributed throughout the world, and we see very clearly particular Y chromosomes that have done really extraordinarily well, and they're by and large, well, always in so far, linked back to historical figures who have not necessarily been as cruel and unpleasant as Genghis Khan, but certainly associated very strongly with wealth and power. And the best examples, I suppose, of those are the chiefs of Scottish clans, where we've done some work and linked back, for example, amongst the MacDonalds. 20% of people called MacDonald are related directly to the founder of the clan, again, living about the same time as Genghis Khan.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. And those chromosomes, those Y chromosomes, they're probably getting on for 400,000, half a million of these Y chromosomes. A lot of them, of course, in the United States and Canada, having come from this one man. So over the course of 700, 800 years, they've increased in frequency from one in the original man to, you know, getting on for half a million. And that's an incredible increase in any kind of evolutionary sense.
Well, then what's going wrong? I guess what's going wrong here? The wise, it seems like, should be prolific, and to some degree you can look at the real capital wise out there, and they certainly seem to be doing their very best to proliferate.
Well, that's the irony, because they clearly they have a story to tell about great proliferations, great wealth, great power of these historical figures, the Scottish clan chiefs, Genghis Khan, and many other minor examples. And the irony is that the Y chromosome, which indirectly causes this evolution of this kind of behavior and the desire to accumulate wealth and property to, if you like, to parallel the peacock's tail, that actually the Y chromosome, which is what tells me as a geneticist about this, is itself far from being anything like, it's not macho, it's not all conquering, it's actually extremely fragile and extremely weak, and that's the irony.
That is an irony, isn't it? So weak and getting weaker, and it's you're suggesting it's under a constant assault, and it's
yes.
What are we going to see? Infertility, will it have any other measurable genetic effects on offspring as time goes on?
That's big enough, isn't it?
Well, it is.
Yes,
of course.
Well, let me say something about why this is the reason, not to confuse the terminology, the reason that the Y chromosome is so particularly fragile. Well, there are two reasons. The first is that unlike all our other chromosomes, and we have 23 other chromosomes in our bodies, unlike all of those, it doesn't actually exchange DNA with other chromosomes at each generation. And that's something that all the other chromosomes do. And the process of exchanging DNA, swapping it around, actually heals mutations.
Uh-huh.
So the Y chromosome can't heal its mutations anywhere near as effectively as the other chromosomes.
Uh-huh.
And also, it actually mutates at a faster rate than the other chromosomes. So an interesting but actually logical reason, and that's the following. That because the Y chromosome is passed from father to son, it's passed, of course, through sperm. And the Y chromosome, say your Y chromosome, you've got it from your father, who got it from his father and from his father, always in sperm. And therefore, it spends its entire life from generation to generation, over dozens, hundreds of generations, always in the germline of males, that's to say the cells are going to produce sperm.
Yeah.
Those are a very unhealthy place for DNA to be, because mutations happen when cells divide, and cells divide at a very, very fast rate in the testes in order so that men can produce 100 million sperm a day or something like that.
Sure.
And it's an incredible fact that the DNA in a man of 60 has already been copied 1,000 times. And so the Y chromosome in a man of 60 has been copied 1,000 times. And although the other chromosomes have also been copied, over time they actually spend, it's a bit hard to really get across, but they actually spend half their time not in the cells that produce sperm, but in the cells that produce eggs. Because they sort of swap around from males to females as the generations pass.
So you're saying in a man of 60 years of age, it's like his Y has been copied on a bad copy machine 1,000 times?
It's a pretty good copying machine, actually, but 1,000 times. So that's, of course, not all men are 60 when they reproduce, but you can see that over 1,000 generations, let's say, then that's a million times it's been copied, and without the ability to repair those mutations, clearly it's an unstable system that will degenerate, and it is.
Yeah, isn't that an evolutionary outrage, Professor? I mean, why would design be such? It would be, I mean, it's like a motor company designing a car to fall apart in 20 years.
What we're onto there is an interesting thing that actually evolution, though it seems to us to have design, doesn't have a design at all. It has no plans for the future.
Uh-oh.
It has no plans for the future. It's been, without getting into the arguments of evolution by natural selection versus creationism, which we could spend the entire program talking about.
No doubt.
Without getting into that argument, it's always been very difficult for evolutionary biologists to understand what is going on with evolution. And it doesn't seem that it's sufficient to say, it's certainly not the case that there's any kind of design element. All that happens is that things change with time, and particularly good traits or things tend to increase, because rather like the peacock's tail example, where they get passed on preferentially to the next generation.
I've got that, but not in the case of the Y chromosome.
Exactly. So there's nothing that nature can do to help, really. It's just unfortunate that our ancient ancestors, when the ancestors of the mammals, very early mammals, it just happened that the way of, producing males and females was put down to a chromosome, because in lots of other animals, it's not done by chromosomes at all. Mm-hmm. We're covering a lot of ground here, but for example, in your American alligators, the sex of the offspring there is not decided by a chromosome, it's decided instead by the temperature at which the egg is incubated. In the early mammals cases, a chromosome had been given that job of deciding whether an embryo would develop into a male or a female. That chromosome was doomed to the gradual decay that we've been talking about.
But one imagines evolution, Professor, to be, by its very nature, a very efficient process.
Well, it's efficient by killing off or not letting survive anything that doesn't really work. So it appears to be efficient because what's left, what survived, is still going. But logically, if we accept that the Y chromosome is gradually deteriorating.
Well, I don't know if I can accept that. We're slowly turning into an appendix.
Sort of. But it does have this. It does have an extremely high mutation rate, and it's not just going to affect us. Of course, it'll affect other mammals. It's just in the long term, the very long term, a really, really bad way of trying to determine whether embryos turn out into males or females, and it might well see the end of mammals altogether. But that's hundreds of millions of years into the future. There's a design flaw in the way we and other mammals decide sex.
Well, perhaps only we see it as a flaw, and evolution sees it just as the way it happens.
Well, it's done reasonably well for over the last 100 million of years. And incidentally, there's a little known theory going around. The mammals were getting nowhere while the dinosaurs were around.
Right.
Only when the dinosaurs died out did they really start to make their mark.
Yes.
And dinosaurs may have, we don't know this, but if they're anything like the alligator or the turtle, they may too have relied on the temperature at which their eggs were incubated to decide whether they were going to be turn out to be Are they going to turn out to be males or females?
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say, for example, that if the dinosaur eggs were incubated at a high temperature, they turn out to be females, and at a low temperature, they turn out to be males. Now, I think most people believe that the dinosaurs were finished off by a meteorite that lowered the temperature of the Earth.
Professor, we're going to have... That's a good place. I
yeah, we
to
can,
hang people
we can
up
carry, up. Carry on with that.
Good. Stay right there, and we'll be right back. We have one of the world's greatest geneticists with us tonight, Professor Brian Sykes, who's written a brand new book. You're going to want to read this one. It's called Adam's Curse.
Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
And we are honored with one of the world's greatest geneticists, Professor Brian Sykes. He's written a book called Adam's Curse. Basically, Adam's curse is that Adam, all of us men, in another 100,000 years or so, we're going to be gone. No more men. No more men. No more men. It seems impossible, and I suppose we'll discuss some of the ramifications and what kind of world that'll be, or the professor thinks it might be. We will get to that. We're back with the dinosaurs at the moment. We'll pick up there right after this. So the evolutionary future unfolding may not include men, eventually. Anyway, we were discussing dinosaurs, I believe, and you said man really didn't take off until the dinosaurs did.
That's right, yeah. The mammals really didn't take off, but nobody's quite sure why the dinosaurs died out. But here's an idea. Alligators and turtles, they both don't rely on chromosomes to decide which is going to be a male and female. Mm-hmm. The eggs decide on the basis of how cold or cool or warm the eggs are when they're being incubated.
Right.
So, let's take a turtle, for example. If the eggs are incubated at 34 degrees centigrade Celsius, they all hatch as females. If they're all incubated at 26 degrees, they all hatch as males. So usually they're kind of in between. Some hatch as males, some as females. Now, if the dinosaurs use the same system, of course, and suddenly the temperature of the Earth went down dramatically by a few degrees, as a lot of people think, when this meteor hit 65 million years ago, blanketing the Earth in dust and reducing the temperature, almost like a nuclear winter, really, then the dinosaurs and any other creatures that used temperature of eggs to determine sex would have ended up, in the case if they had that sort of hot female, cool male system, all the dinosaurs would have been male. And, of course, they'd have gone overnight.
That'd be the end of, yeah.
Yeah. So if that were the case, and it's not proven or even much thought about, actually, but it would be one way that what had up to then been an extremely good way of deciding sex and evolutionarily, you know, perfectly in tune and had lasted for many hundreds of years, they'd have gone overnight.
Professor, wouldn't that mean that as perhaps an asteroid or whatever could have accomplished that, perhaps even a rapid cyclical climate change would have done the same thing, huh?
Well, it would have to be pretty rapid, really.
Yeah.
But, you know, an asteroid or a large meteor impact, which is thought by many, and there's evidence of this to have happened, reduce the temperature. Any organism that defend, or any animal that depends on temperature to decide sex would have the sex ratios, the ratio between men and females,
yes,
drastically altered.
But there are those troublesome woolly mammoths with the frozen greenery in their mouths.
Oh, those, yeah, yeah, that's right. But although that's right. I think they die for other reasons. They were regular mammals, no doubt about that. All right, but the point I'm trying to get at is that the way in which sex is decided is not necessarily going to save a species or save a whole order of animals. And I think, in the case of the mammals, relying as we have on chromosomes, and by once we've done that, the chromosome that decides sex is doomed to ultimate decay. Well, nothing's going to help.
Nothing will help.
Well, the only thing that's going to help is if we, now realizing this danger, could actually do something about it.
Manipulate. Mike in Utah says, not all genetic mutations are bad. It seems like many could actually improve the viability of the Y chromosome. How do you take that into account?
It's quite right. Not all mutations are bad. But, you'll probably find that some mutations on Y chromosomes have helped to boost fertility. But most mutations are damaging, and I think the number of bad mutations, for the reasons, you know, that the Y chromosome is always restrained to the testes of germline cells of men, will eventually overtake the occasional good mutation that results as because of that.
So this battle is ongoing, the deterioration is ongoing, and you suggest it will be a linear deterioration until finally the end, out at 100, 125,000 years, whatever.
Well, that's if the world lasts that long, of course.
Yeah, not such a good bet to take.
Right. And that, you know, and I develop the theme that is the other side of Adam's curse. At the, if you like, the peacock's tail equivalent in our own species is the accumulation of wealth and power and property and so on. And the thing about the peacock's tail is that it can only grow so large. If a peacock has, peacocks would love to have tails 100 feet long.
Yeah.
But of course, if they did, they couldn't even fly. So a leopard wandering along would soon finish him off. But with our sort of social equivalent of the peacock's tail, wealth and power, property, status, and those sorts of things, there is no limit to the amount that individuals can accumulate, you know, in the same way that there is to the size of the peacock's tail. So the only limit really is the ability of the of our planet to sustain the production of sufficient wealth and power and status and those kinds of things. So in that sense, whether the Earth lasts for 100,000 years to witness the eventual extinction of men through the Y chromosome, if it doesn't last that long, it's because of the Y chromosome's other effect. So Adam's curse in that sense, is a double whammy, a double blow.
Yes. I suppose somebody with a great big colorful tail might one day push the wrong button, and then we wouldn't make our 100,000 years anyway.
No, we would not.
Well, let's for a second jump back, because it's such a big question in society. I don't know, perhaps in your research you have made some determination about homosexuality, and so many numbers are tossed about. Is male, homosexuality, period, is it on the increase? Do you have any statistics that would tell us whether it's actually increasing, or has it been static for as long as we know?
Well, Art, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I'm not an expert on homosexuality. I have a chapter in the book on Adam's Curse about it, but as to knowing the statistics which you asked me about it, I won't say anything because I really don't know much about it, and it's
fine.
Best to say that straight out, really.
Uh-huh.
Clearly, homosexuality, the reason I was interested in writing about it was the following. About 10 years ago, there's a couple of scientific papers which said that they had found a gay gene. I don't know if you remember that.
I vaguely do,
yeah.
Yes.
And it didn't really make any sense to me or a lot of other geneticists at the time, because if there were a gay gene, let's say that such a thing existed, then clearly, in these present day anyway, I think it's probably true that male homosexuals have less offspring, less children than straight men.
Mm-hmm.
So that gay gene, if a man had it, a gay man had it, he would not be passing on to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And under those circumstances, it's very, very difficult to see how gay genes would have really ever got to the present generation, if you like, at anywhere like the numbers, if that was the sole cause of male homosexuality. Those genes would not have got through.
Professor, do you believe there will ever be any discovery in genetics that ties itself to homosexuality?
Well, that's what I was going to go on to. I've had a look back at the original papers that purported to find and reported the gay gene, and I've sort of come to the conclusion, I mean, it's a very tentative and provocative proposal, that there is no such thing as a gay gene itself,
mm-hmm.
but that there is, that male homosexuality, and don't ask me about female homosexuality because it doesn't apply, is actually the one consequence of a very fundamental genetic battle that's going on between the Y chromosome on one hand, and these other genetic entities called mitochondria on the other.
So in a way, my emailer, Arlene, was sort of onto something. Maybe.
Yes, yes. I believe there is, the genetics is, there is a genetic component to male homosexuality, but it's not a gay gene as such.
I understand. But what you're suggesting is fascinating, and what you're suggesting would mean that as this process continues, generation after generation, the numbers of homosexuals, if that's true, would probably increase, wouldn't they?
Well, I think you're misunderstanding what I'm saying, actually.
I guess I am.
I'm not saying that it's got anything to... It's not got anything intrinsically to do with the Y chromosome decay that we've been talking about. It's to do with the battle between mitochondria on the one hand
uh-huh.
and Y chromosomes on the other.
Uh-huh.
Those two have entirely different genetic agendas. So, mitochondria, which are passed from mother to daughter and so on through the generations, they have absolutely no interest, of course we're we're kind of anthropomorphizing these genes, but it's helpful to look at them in that way. They have no interest. A woman's mitochondria has no interest in her ever having sons, because that mitochondria is not going to get anywhere through her having sons. In the same way, Y chromosomes, a man's Y chromosome, has no interest at all in him having daughters. So here you have two polar opposites in these. And if you believe, as I do and many others do, that genes actually are a very important determinant of evolution, then to have that real completely different conflict of interest between two genes is going to play out in many ways. And looking, for example, taking the mitochondria, the one that, if you like, is, well, the one that is going from female to female, has no interest whatsoever in males, it's now emerging that if males do inherit mitochondria, but they don't pass it on because there's none in sperm to speak of. But it's, so mitochondria have no interest in males, and it's now emerging that quite a lot of diseases which men get, including aging and many of these other things, which men suffer earlier than women, is actually caused by mitochondrial decay. So what I'm getting at here in a very roundabout way is that mitochondria are slowly killing men and preserving women. I mean, that's why, so many people think, that men get older quicker and die younger than women. So what's it got to do with homosexuality? Well, the other thing that mitochondria do is to, women do, unconsciously of course, is that they do often abort unconsciously at a very early age, miscarry, and the first there's an excess of male fetuses that are miscarried in the very first few weeks of pregnancy, often unknown. Women don't know they're even pregnant when this happens. And you could, and I do suggest in my book, that this is another aspect of mitochondria trying to destroy male fetuses.
Wow. That's pretty controversial, all right.
Well, it's controversial, and a thing about being a geneticist is that you think about things sometimes in and you have to in a rather impersonal way. But then, of course, naturally, you sort of say these things, and interpreting them on a sort of very large evolutionary timescale. And, of course, especially late miscarriages are absolute tragedies. Early ones, very early ones, often not known about. But I think the war between mitochondria and the Y chromosome is so bitter that it wouldn't stop at that. What about the Y chromosomes? How do they sort of fight back? Well, Y chromosomes themselves are in rather a weak position because they're very vulnerable, and if this war really is going on, which I believe it is, they're very vulnerable in those 9 months that they spend when going from one generation to another in the body of a woman. And so they must fight back against this tendency to try and eliminate all male fetuses, which mitochondria have. And here's where the male homosexuality comes in. Since there is a balance, there must be a balance between these two forces, otherwise one would have dominated already, then there's a possibility, and there's evidence to suggest this looking back at the original pedigrees, the family studies where the gay gene was first found, that male homosexuals have fewer uncles than aunts. That's so their mothers have got fewer brothers and sisters, which, if we meld this into this idea I've just been talking about, suggests that male homosexuals' mothers, their own mothers, have been actually very adept at eliminating male fetuses.
I was going to say winning the battle.
Yeah, they've won the battle. So what is the next stage if you can't kill a male fetus? What's the next best thing you can do? And that is to make sure that Y chromosomes don't succeed the next generation, is to, if you can, adjust their sexual preference so that they never breed.
It's insidious.
Otherwise they become homosexual.
Yes, it's insidious, isn't it?
It's very insidious, and it's one way that, as a geneticist, that I look at this battle. But it's a very, very interesting, a very, very deadly battle that's going on between.
Well, I think, Professor, what I was trying to ask is it a static standoff, or is the victory increasingly going to the women?
Well, in the case of homosexuality, as I said, I don't know the statistics about whether or not the male homosexuality is increasing, and I don't know the figures about that. And what I'm just suggesting, which is really sticking my neck out, but it's just basically food for thought.
I certainly caught what you're suggesting. Yep. Professor, hold on a moment. We'll get right back to you. Within the women's body, there's a war going on. It's a war against males, actually, and the war is being won by the females. And the result of that, in one particular case, might be homosexuality. I'm Art Bell.
Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Evolution takes us, obviously, along a lot of paths, but none of them are back where we started from. We will, however, be right back. Once again, you're listening to one of the world's greatest geneticists, Professor Brian Sykes. And here he is. I guess I was asking you, and I'll try again, whether you think or even would like to take a guess about whether this process is a static process and whether it would continue to produce in the population as this war goes on against males. a similar number of those with an inclination to homosexuality, or whether it's also part of the overall battle that's going to ultimately be lost. I mean, that.
I suppose, thinking about it, and I haven't predicted anything in the book, but if mitochondria, which, is, according to this idea that I put forward in the book, is at least partially responsible for male homosexuality, if they get very good at it, they will succeed better than mitochondria that aren't quite so good at it.
Yes.
And so I guess the predicted outcome from that would be that male homosexuality would increase.
Would increase. Interestingly, Adam from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Adam, can you believe it? So, fascinating show, Art. I'm a gay male. And I have now taken notice of the fact that my mom has four sisters, no brothers. My grandma on her side of the family had three sisters, no brothers.
Well,
interesting.
Yep, I mean, you'd obviously have to have a lot more examples of that, but I suppose, you know, that's an interesting family. I think the studies which I quote in Adam's Curse are, you know, involved hundreds of gay men, and actually I could have, I'll quickly look it up while we're talking.
You might want to hit the database on that one.
Well, it's called a book. It's chapter 23.
Uh-huh. Well, that's okay, all right. Maybe, yeah. I mean, as you get to it, you can get to it.
I will get to it.
Does this ultimately really mean, Professor?
Here we are, I've got it. Okay.
Yes.
A survey of nearly 500 gay men.
Yes.
Their mothers had a total of 209 sisters, but only 132 brothers.
Holy smokes!
Yep. So that's, of course, they should have had equal numbers of brothers.
Yeah, indeed, or very close.
So that's an impressive figure. Adam, from where was he from?
You might, Milwaukee. You know,
Milwaukee.
You might have another book here.
So, but 209 against 132 is pretty skewed, isn't it?
It is. It's still, I suppose, from a scientific point of view, a small sample relatively. But yes,
well,
it's very.
I don't know. I mean, it's not that small actually. I mean, 209 to 132 is very significant, even though, of course, it's not absolutely huge, but it's a very significant.
Well, shouldn't it be so significant as to cause more immediate research?
Well, it's very odd, actually. Reading about the genetics of research into homosexuality from a genetic point of view, I mean, there was this these papers that we've mentioned that came out about just over 10 years ago, and there was another paper that followed up to agree with the first one or corroborate the findings, and then there was a third paper which disagreed. That's actually not uncommon in genetics, and then nothing. So it's been totally dropped from the research agenda, as far as I can see.
Well, that alone is fascinating. As big of an issue, I mean, it's a giant issue socially, so I'm really quite surprised that it's not being followed up on.
Well, it did cause a lot of stir at the time. I think it's...
I'm sure.
I know a lot of gay men... I wasn't involved in this original research at all, but I've just, in my researching for Adam's Curse, read about the reactions to this. And while a lot of gay men welcomed this research, and many said quite vehemently that research into the genetics of male homosexuality should not be done at all. But certainly the fact is that nothing has been done. But I think this new angle that I'm hinting at, that there's no gay gene, but it's that male homosexuality is a consequence of this,
yes,
this deeply embedded war, that may stimulate a bit more research. I don't know.
Would you think that if something were proven in this area, Professor, that society would then view that as a disease, or do you think society would be sold on the fact that it's just part of a unavoidable evolutionary change?
It certainly wouldn't be a disease. It certainly isn't a disease. It's part of this deeply embedded and irreconcilable conflict, genetic conflict that goes on between men and women, between male and female.
I clearly have that. I just wonder if that would promote a general acceptance of that fact as opposed to what we have now.
Well, there are reminiscences of this kind of thing in other animals. I mean, there are actually other animals in which the war between the mitochondria and males goes on in many other animals. In fact, some insects, we're going a little off subject here, but some insects,
quite
for example, right, actually the mitochondria and other associated genes in the cell cytoplasm, as it's called, outside the nucleus, actually kill male embryos. I mean, stone dead. I mean, it's been observed, extremely well documented. But the production of homosexual offspring has actually also been recorded in some other animals.
Many argue that's not true, and they use that as a platform to launch. Anyway,
yeah.
You're saying it is true.
Yes, it's certainly true in other animals. But what the situation, as I'm proposing that it worth at least some serious examination, is very reminiscent of a type of genetic altruism. So, to cut a long story short, I don't think that male homosexuality in my idea, is a disease at all, but it's actually an example of genetic altruism.
And gotcha.
The reason is that if a mitochondria that had produced a homosexual son, if that son did not marry but actually helped, this is complicated, so hold on, actually helped his mother bring up his sisters,
mm-hmm,
that mitochondria would have a huge advantage,
mm-hmm,
and would spread. And that is a piece of genetic altruism whereby you're helping your own genes get through the next generation, not through yourself, but through your relatives. It's seen a lot in other animals.
So on the side of the ultimate winners.
Yes, that's right.
Would be
It's an altruism. It's certainly not a disease.
Yes, fascinating. Oh, fascinating. Mm. All right.
You see what us geneticists get up to every day.
I guess I do. Yes, I guess I do. Is there any way that you see that, and I bet there are many for you, that man will survive this, that man will learn to manipulate ourselves, if we so desire, back to a capital Y? And I suppose you have mixed feelings about that, but...
Right, okay, yes. Well, naturally, because I think this process is of decay will carry on, I have thoughts, well, what can be done about it? Well,
mm-hmm,
actually, it can be arrested by taking those genes which we know are necessary on the Y chromosome and rescuing them, taking them off and by genetic manipulation, putting
mm-hmm
them onto other chromosomes out of harm's way, if you like.
Mm.
Really
messing with Mother Nature.
Well, really messing with Mother Nature, yeah.
And could it be that the only ultimate survival, remember we were speculating about whether the world would even survive that long?
Yes.
Could it be that for the ultimate survival of the species, this deterioration and final collapse of the Y chromosome has to happen. And if it doesn't happen, then the world will end.
Well, you've actually put your finger on it there, Art. yeah. Now, the question is, if the Y chromosome goes, or when the Y chromosome goes, and if there's no genetic manipulation solution, what will happen then? Well, as things stand, of course, as things stand, if males disappear, then women will also disappear as well. The whole species will become extinct. But I propose in my book, which I finished writing about a year ago, that it wouldn't be long before it was possible to create an embryo and eventually a human by fertilizing an egg, not with a sperm, but with another egg. So this would be where you took an egg from one woman and you you mixed it, you injected essentially the egg from the chromosomes of an egg from another woman,
right,
and to produce reimplanted that, you'd have to use the sort of in vitro fertilization techniques that we now have, implanted that into back into one of the women, and that would produce a girl, and it would be a perfectly normal girl. Now,
with genetic characteristics of both parents.
With genetic characteristics of both parents, the only difference would be that both the parents would be women.
Female, yep, got it.
Now, I thought this was going to take a long time, but believe it or not, the week before last, there's a report in the journal Nature of exactly this having been done with a mouse. Some Japanese and Korean scientists took the egg from one mouse and fused it with the egg from another and created a mouse, which a female mouse, which was born and from all appearances was completely normal. In fact, went on to have a litter of her own. So it looks as though that is a distinct possibility that the species could survive by fusing one egg with another and reproducing in that way without males whatsoever, because of this mouse, the Japanese mouse, had no father,
yeah,
had no genetic input from a male at all.
But assuming an artificial womb, then men could do the same thing.
Well, men could if you had an artificial womb, yes, they could.
Well, if we're going to look 100,000 years into the future...
But if they have artificial wombs, and they essentially you're treating them as sperm as if it were an egg, they really are, for all intents and purposes, females anyway.
And so...
It gets complicated, doesn't it?
Yes, it
does. But what you were saying is very apt as well.
Well, we're talking about cloning here.
Well, we're not talking about cloning. We've come back to that. But would the world be more likely to survive if there were only women and no longer men?
Clearly, most people would answer yes.
Well, what do you think?
You want honesty, right?
Yes.
I think the world would have a far better chance of survival if it were women that inherited.
I agree.
That's sort of embarrassing and, you know, hard to admit. But it might not be as magnificent a place, Professor.
It certainly wouldn't be.
Without all those whys.
Certainly not so much fun. And
clearly.
Not so interesting, but probably more peaceful, I think. Then touching on what the Japanese had done and the Japanese who created this mouse importantly would not be a clone. That's very important.
Gotcha.
It's the same kind of natural mixture of genes as any other normal girl because it had two different biological parents.
Mm-hmm.
Cloning will never really work in the long term for any species. And the reason is, interestingly enough, that cloning, of course, produces genetically identical copies of an organism, of an animal,
right,
or a plant.
Right.
And that's fine. It's actually a very efficient way of reproducing, except that you're very vulnerable to being wiped out by parasites or pathogens. And we can see exactly this happening in the banana crop, of all things, in South America and Costa Rica. Hmm. What's happened there is that all the bananas, in fact, all the bananas in the world, are clones. They're all reproduced. They don't reproduce sexually. They reproduce by cloning. They're just taken, one sort of cutting is taken and then transplanted onto another root.
Yes.
So what's happened in South America is that a fungus has unlocked the key to killing off one banana plant, if you like. And because all the other banana plants are genetically identical, it's now sweeping right across South America, and it will eventually decimate the, it's already doing it, decimate the banana, the crop.
So as one is vulnerable, all are vulnerable since they're cloned. And so you're telling me it's the end of bananas?
Yeah.
That was a yes?
Yes, it's the end of the bananas. Unless something's done about it, unless they introduce non-cloning reproduction eventually. It is a serious threat. I mean, it's not me that's saying it's the end of banana.
That's horrible.
Yeah. But that's the danger of cloning. So any species that relies on reproduction without sex, without males and females, is taking that risk. We, of course, and the reason is that you have genetic identity, but and that's actually why sexual reproduction with males and females takes place at all. It's so that you mix up the genes at each generation, and you protect the species,
sure,
against this kind of mass elimination by parasites or funguses or viruses or whatever. So in our case, there's been tremendous epidemics, pandemics even. There's one going on with AIDS, of course, now. But it won't kill everybody because there's enough genetic variation to make sure a few survive at the very least.
Right. Since you're a geneticist, I've really got what I think is a good question for you.
Uh-huh.
Many times on this program we talk about aliens, as in from another, you know, world, another planet, another whatever.
Yeah, okay.
And they're lovingly called grays. And I've always wondered, with all the interracial breeding that's going on, and boy, there's a lot of it going on in the world right now, eventually, and would be you that I'd have to ask, and I will after the break, won't we all be grays? Aren't we on the way to becoming the grays ourselves? Think about that. Aren't we well underway right now? Aren't we headed toward becoming what we talk about? The grays, right?
Sweet dreams are made of.
talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903.
Oh, yeah, just one more thing, folks. Have you ever noticed in every depiction of an alien gray, every single one of them, just one little thing. They're all female. It is interesting, isn't it? I mean, that what are depicted on the screen and in popular literature all over the world as the aliens, in quotes, they're the grays, right? And if you think about it, they're all females. I mean, just a thought, folks. Professor, since I have you here, I really would like to ask you a little bit about this. I mean, aren't we in the process of becoming the grays?
You'll have to explain a bit more what you mean, really.
Okay. What I mean by that is, in America now, why things have changed. Black people are no longer slaves. They're in our media. They have sex appeal. Asians are in our media. We have some of our biggest pop stars now. In other words, in our culture, we have really mixed. I mean, we have mixed marriages going on all over the place. A lot of people don't like it. That's fine for them, but it's happening.
Yep.
And the result of those mixed marriages ultimately is going to, is it not, erase the distinction between the variants?
Well, if you sort of, supposing just, you know, to paint a completely fanciful scenario, supposing you sealed the borders now, and within America, that everyone, husbands and wives' marriages were totally random. That's to say, you wouldn't necessarily marry into someone in your ethnic group, which, of course, happened a lot. Eventually, you'd find that there would be a great sharing of characteristics, genetic characteristics, and more uniformity. Yes, you would.
Yes.
You
yes.
would.
Yes, yes, exactly. And that process is perhaps in its beginnings from an evolutionary point of view, but gee, I wonder how many generations of mixture you'd have to look at before you finally got to pretty much of a constant, or what appeared to be a constant anyway.
Well,
it would ultimately occur, would it not?
The thing is, though, Art, that if you look back at the history of the world, and you can sort of glimpse this through genetic spectacles or telescope, if you like, you soon realize that actually this kind of mixing that you're talking about that's happening now in America has actually always been happening. It's been happening ever since we started to evolve. There's never been any such thing as a pure race or a pure ethnic group.
No, it's not
they
always.
They themselves are mixtures.
Yes, but it's not always been socially as acceptable as it is now, and so it's proliferating.
Well, it's hard to say whether it was socially acceptable or not in the past, but it certainly has always gone on. And I think what we're seeing in America and other parts of the world, of course, is really a mixing of people that in not so long in the past were geographically separated by large distances.
That's right. Yes.
But it's a fallacy to think that mixing of this kind of has not been going on throughout the entire history of human evolution.
Mm-hmm. Is it not genetically actually advantageous to have a very dissimilar mixture occur? Isn't the offspring frequently of these dissimilar mixtures advantaged in some manner because of the dissimilar nature of the genetic makeup? Is that true? Is that true?
Well, it's there's we're sort of going back to getting into dangerous territory here. I mean, because
I live on dangerous territory.
Right. Okay. But there was a period. For example, if you not talking about humans now, but crossing different strains of plants, for example, there is a phenomenon of called hybrid vigor.
Mm-hmm.
Called hybrid vigor, and that aptly describes exactly what it is. That if you have hybrids, which in the plant sense means crossing different strains together,
right,
slightly genetically different, then you did get a
very robust,
a robust form. But what probably you don't realize in humans is that actually we're really, even though we may not think we are or even think we look like it, we actually are an extraordinarily recent species. So there hasn't been time to for significant genetic differences to build up between people in who live in different parts of the world. So that means that hybrid vigor, as it's called in amongst the plants, where you're actually taking quite genetically dissimilar strains and crossing those and seeing a more vigorous hybrid between when you had looked at those separate strains, we just haven't really had enough time to develop sufficiently distinct genetic differences between different people in different parts of the world. We are an incredibly recent species.
Mm-hmm.
We originated in Africa, Homo sapiens, only an astonishingly short time ago, perhaps 150,000 years, which is nothing really compared to most other species that are around.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and actually that's one of the sort of byproducts of the kind of research I've been doing as well on mitochondria and on microenzymes. You can track back through time to show that everyone on the planet is actually very closely related.
Mm-hmm.
And getting back to a question of hybrid vigor, if you like, because everyone is really so very genetically similar, you won't see any great improvements by any mixing of people who have lived in completely different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. So we're so basically similar that you're not going to get hybrid vigor, is what you're saying.
That's right.
Very interesting. All right, listen, this is a talk show, and we like to take calls, so I'm going to take a few, and let's see how we do. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Sykes. Hi.
Hi there.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. First-time caller line, you're on the air, now or never.
Hello.
Hello.
I
almost hung up on you, dear. You're slow on the draw there. What?
All right.
You're on the air.
Maison from San Antonio.
Yes.
Men win the war on women every few minutes with well-documented rapes, beatings, and murders. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Since women can't even get help with housework, the equal reaction is on a small scale. Female might in mitochondria. Men blaming women for own karmic boomerang is a typical Jungian and male pattern of projecting the shadow self. Cause all their wars. Men who take all the power, profit, and pleasure from themselves just can't figure out why the third world and women, terrified continuously by violence and poverty, might reflect it back in desperate suicide terrorism. Also, male homosexuality to women is just another war front affront. The only men who dress well and do their own laundry and have charm and wit, these men are the answer to what do women want.
Are you one of Professor Sykes' students?
No. I'm nearly finished. But gay men withhold romance, which is women's obsession and orgasm, for other men. And straight men satisfy their desires with prostitution, computer porn, phone sex, and strippers.
Oh, okay.
In this man's world, women's only other employment opportunities are as nurses and maids.
Mm-hmm.
Is it any wonder that Mother Nature, as a conscious gaia force, perhaps has an alternative evolution beyond male labs and ET?
Yikes.
So the irresponsible drugs and bad diet and everything are part of the degeneration of the genes.
All right. Well, it was while you're ahead.
That wasn't a question, but that was. I really think that was great.
These are the kinds of things that happen when you open the phone line, Professor.
It is, but I must say that it doesn't sound like that lady will miss men too much in the future.
No, I got that sense. I definitely got that sense. And I guess, in a way, what she just said sort of underlines everything you've been saying, doesn't it?
Well, I'm sure she'll enjoy reading Adam's Curse.
Okay. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Professor Sykes. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hey, it's a very much a privilege, and that young lady was right on target. I hate to say it. In this month, I'm a Taurus.
Yeah, you're a sympathizer, too. You're
and
a sympathizer, aren't you?
I'm a sympathizer with her. But my question is, the value of man and woman with stem cell research and cloning, they could eliminate us both very easily. And how much spiritual and...
Well, but wait a minute. Stop right there. First of all, I think that the professor destroyed your cloning thought.
Okay. Yes. But anyway, the thing with the men in power and whatnot that can do what they want to with women, that pretty much is gone. That's out the window. Women have the power now to control a lot of things.
All right. Professor, now he makes a very good point. If you look at the social... the way we are presently socially constructed in the United States, there certainly has been a sea change, hasn't there?
Yes, there has. But it certainly hasn't occurred all over the world. There's in many other countries, women are just as badly treated as they ever were.
Hmm. That's true.
So, yes, you're absolutely right. There's huge changes are taking place now in America and in European countries. And
yes, and where freedom rings, these changes are occurring.
They are, that's right. And they're all to the good as far as I can see. But what can I say? I mean, it won't arrest the decline of the Y chromosome, but let's hope it arrests this the other effects of Adam's curse that we've been talking about.
You know, Professor, I'm really curious. When you had the news release that flashed around the world about all of this those months ago,
yes.
What kind of reaction was there?
Okay, well, I've all sorts of reactions, really, but, I mean, one, I've been accused quite often of sort of being a traitor to the male sex, if you like, to my
mm-hmm.
own gender.
Mm-hmm.
And on that, actually, I think it would have been hard to write this book if I'd been a woman, actually, because I would have been then accused of having of my own agenda, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So there were some quite vicious letters and emails
mm-hmm.
that I was somehow letting men down, as it were.
Yeah.
I don't really see it like that at all. But
of course not.
But
they were. You said the word vicious.
Yes.
Yes. People don't understand how very difficult it is to be a messenger, and how perilous it's truly perilous to be a messenger, particularly this kind of news.
Hmm. Well, I mean, in a way, there's. They didn't amount to anything, I'm glad to say, but in a way they kind of proved the point, really, didn't they?
So, anyway. In other words, you accepted most of those emails as evidence.
And then there were, and that, but then they were equally balanced, or balanced far more by people who, I mean, of course, the press release and what happened, what went out around the wires and stuff, it was only a very summary, really, but, I mean, so they were balanced by many messages which, well, I'm not exactly looking for, well, not looking forward to the end of men.
Well, let's put it right out there. How many sounded like that young lady?
Well, not very many, actually, because what was interesting was that when I've asked, you know, I've asked people, and I've had responses to, well, even though a lot of women say, well, men are utterly useless and all the rest of it, we've heard that incantation for many, many years now. But actually, women have said, oh no, I mean, a world without women would be utterly awful. So not like that lady from San Antonio, was it? So I think, in a sense, of course, when it actually happened, of course, men would be completely forgotten. I mean, like the dodo or something like that, never would have been known, but certainly a world without men would be extremely difficult and different, and would be more boring, I guess.
Well, maybe so, but that, I'll tell you, that lady could have been their leader.
Yes, she could, and I mean, yeah, I hope she enjoys reading Adam's Curse, because she'll find a lot of things, even more ammunition for her poetry and prose.
Well, all right, if she wants Adam's Curse, where would she go? I mean, would it probably be Amazon.com?
You can get it from Amazon, but as I say, it was published last Monday, so in the United States, so it's in Barnes & Noble and all the all good bookshops, as they say.
Excellent. I'm sure many will be on their way. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Sykes. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering about pollution, especially those that mimic estrogen, called estrogenic compounds. I was listening to a terribly disturbing study by Dr. Steve Nugent, who was at one time the president of the American Naturopaths. And he was saying that not only is male sterility on the rise of all species all over the world, but also some intersex births or hermaphrodites, which is what the grays are supposed to be, not female, but hermaphrodites. So my question is, are you aware of any of this affecting maleness?
Yes. In fact, in Adam's Curse, I've got a chapter on this, and it certainly seems to be true that male infertility, and particularly as judged by sperm counts, for example, has been going down quite rapidly in the last 50 years all over the world. And although it's not absolutely certain what the cause for this is, certainly the finger has been pointed at pollutants, as you say, that mimic estrogens, and things in our diet and in the environment that were not there before. And some even quite healthy sounding things actually do mimic estrogens, like soya beans, for example. There's an estrogen-like compound in soya beans. Also, some plasticizers have an estrogen-like activity, and that's again, not entirely proven, but it is thought to be at least one of the major reasons why the sperm count in men is going down. Now, in Adam's Curse, I kind of treat that as another irony, in the sense that, and in fact, the lady from San Antonio drew a parallel between the feminine and Gaia, the goddess of the world.
Oh, she did.
She did. And so the getting back to another argument, trying to get all these arguments together.
All right, Professor, do get them together.
I will after the break.
We're here. There you go. Boy, he's getting good. So you're on radio for a little while. You learn about these breaks very quickly. The lady from San Antonio. Well, she said it all, huh?
Since the day I saw the cat at my door, so I came into you, sweet lady, answering your
wonder if Juliet and Juliet would rest as easily.
To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Well, what a program this has been. Professor Brian Sykes is my guest, and yes, he's a professor and very professor-like. But if you've been listening very carefully this morning, I hope you have, because there have been some truly amazing, controversial revelations laid out across this program this morning. I'm Art Bell, and we'll be right back. Adam's Curse is the name of the book. It's a book you're really going to want. It's just out by Brian Sykes, author of the best-selling The Seven Daughters of Eve. Once again, Adam's Curse is the name of the book, and you absolutely are going to want to grab this as quickly as you can. I can tell you I'm going to be reading it quite quickly. Professor, you have, I just noticed, you have an entire chapter called Gaia's Revenge.
That's right, yes, and getting back to what we were talking about before the break.
Yes.
And putting a lot of arguments together and the way in which sexual selection has led to the accumulation of wealth and power and how that has shaped the modern world, really, while at the same time, in its battle against the feminine, has polluted the modern world. And Gaia's Revenge is all about how the feminine, in two respects, first of all, well, let's talk about the pollution, that isn't it ironic that the world seen as a feminine entity, as Gaia, the Earth goddess, is hitting back at males in just the place it hurts, that's to say, by the pollutants dropping the sperm count. Now, just when I say that, just in the question of, you know, in a couple of sentences, I sound like completely bananas, but in fact I do develop that theme a little more carefully in that chapter, Gaia's Revenge.
Well, it may have a lot in common with bananas. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Sykes. Hello. Hello?
Hello, Art?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'd like to ask your guest, since he's already cited male homosexuality as a possible means by which the mitochondria strikes back at the Y chromosome, whether any studies have ever been done about female autism. How many uncles do autists who are female have versus aunts? Because I was wondering if this could not be yet another kink in this war, whether this could be the Y chromosome striking back again at the mitochondria and saying, well, okay, I'll see that women are born, but that if they're that when they're born, they aren't going to really want to reproduce all that much, be able to take care of their kids, be able to act in the ways that, well, never mind attracting men, will be able to keep them around,
yes.
Will be able to keep a husband and father around. I ask this because I have it, and I am related to a woman who is absolutely crippled with the same condition. I have many more uncles, many more male relatives on my father's side than female, and I have somewhat more relatives on my mother's side than female. My mother's half-brother, who,
okay, Ryan, you don't have to go on. By extension,
yeah.
It's a wonderful question, Professor.
It is a wonderful question, isn't it? And
yes.
The only thing is I don't have a wonderful answer, I'm afraid. It's an absolutely brilliant question, and I'm ashamed to say I've never considered it. I know that there is a genetic input to autism, and certain genes have been implicated in it, but I've never considered it as the opposite way around, that if you like, the Y chromosome battling against the mitochondrion. But since that is such a deeply embedded war, it's certainly something, as soon as I get back to Oxford, I will have a look at. So thank you very much. Well, I'm really sorry that I haven't got an answer to the question.
That's quite all right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Sykes. Hello.
Hi, is that me?
That's you.
Oh, good. Okay, I guess this relates a little bit to the former caller, but I remember when I was in university and we studied double Y individuals, and these are men with the XYY with a double Y gene.
Yes.
And they were very aggressive, and
right.
There were studies done that showed that many prisoners have this double Y.
I actually think that it has been proffered in, as a defense, a legal defense.
Well,
so I was wondering if it's still happening,
okay.
How it happens, if it's part of the
okay.
All right, Professor?
Can I answer that question?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, it's certainly true that amongst inmates of in prisons, that there's a higher proportion of men with two Y chromosomes than among the normal population. But there's plenty of men in the normal population with two Y chromosomes who are not in the least bit criminally inclined. And when those results were first produced, probably 20 years ago now, then clearly the explanation that, well, they got double dose of this dangerous chromosome was accepted, and it all seemed to fit in very well.
Mm.
What's since happened is that there's now that it's probably not as stark as we thought. It's just the fact that they've got three chromosomes when they should have two.
Yes.
And there are other types of diseases where you have too many chromosomes that are also found at higher frequencies in prisons and amongst offenders.
But if you look at very well-to-do, famous, or powerful men, Professor, do you think that you might see a higher percentage of double Ys?
It's possible, but that's not been done as far as I know.
I see. All right.
Maybe we should start.
Maybe we should. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Professor Sykes. Good morning.
Yeah, hello?
Hello.
Yeah. Professor, you're very interesting. Earlier, and of course just now, you mentioned that the mitochondria attacks the Y chromosomes. I'm assuming then, and I want to make sure if you do or not, that you accept that fertilization and mitosis is based on the theory of epigenesis?
Theory of?
Is that correct?
I'm sorry, could you...
You accept then epigenesis.
Oh, epigenesis.
Yeah.
Epigenesis.
The basis for mitosis and fertilization. Because I have another question.
Well, all right, hold on. I don't even understand.
Well, epigenesis is the term that means the genetic impact and influence of things that lie outside the chromosomes.
Okay.
Okay.
So,
mitochondria and what we've been talking about with mitochondria is strictly speaking epigenesis. So yes.
Okay. Now, if that is the case, do you have you heard or do you believe in the possibility of the theory of parthenogenesis, that there are two vestigial glands, the parouferoun and the opoferoun, that a female has in the mesosuphenx that is now somewhat dormant? And that this also might be the cause for dermoid cysts, for virgin birth in this
sense. Yeah, okay.
All right.
So parthenogenesis is where some animals actually, and it's been thought that occasionally women will produce children without men, without having their eggs fertilized at all. I mean, it's never been proven in the case of any humans, but certainly that's the way that many animals reproduce, but of course they produce clones in that way. So strictly speaking, it's very unlikely to happen in humans, but it's not entirely ruled out. But if there were any examples of it, then the offspring would be an identical clone to the mother. And genetic tests nowadays would prove that very easily. So
we'd be right back to the banana problem, wouldn't we?
Yeah, we would. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Be hopeless.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Sykes. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for a very exciting and enlightening program. My name is Paula. I'm calling from Canton, Ohio, listening to you out of Akron over 6:40 a.m. WHLO.
Yes.
And I had two questions for Dr. Sykes. It is Sykes, right? S-I-K-E-S?
No, S-Y-K-E-S.
S-Y, thank you. I wanted to know, first off, in the Orient, when female babies were born, they were killed upon birth,
mm-hmm.
and not so that they wanted to get rid of the females.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, did that have any impact on the male babies? Did they finally produce more male babies there then? And question number two, I will preface this, Art, with you having had so many guests on your program between you and George over the years about ETs or maybe us from the future coming back and doing medical, I don't know, genetic manipulation maybe, or experiments taking
Yes.
taking eggs and sperm from males and females, because the thought was their race was dying out.
Yes.
So does Dr. Sykes think, or is he, with him being a geneticist and a scientist, is his research into this Y chromosome thing, does that have any bearing on the ETs, or maybe it's just
that one's
back.
Over the top for current discussion.
Well, I can answer both those questions.
Yeah, you sure can.
Okay, the first one was about female babies being killed
in China
and in India.
Yes, indeed.
And also abortions done selectively to destroy female children.
Yes.
That in Adam's case, it's interesting how many things from your listeners have actually are reproducing that. And of course, I do talk about that. I feel that is another way, a conscious way, in which the Y chromosome is being propagated by the purposeful and deliberate murder of young girls. So that's one thing. As to aliens coming in from the future or getting into the gene pool, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
In all the work I and others have done to reconstruct human evolution, we've never seen any DNA from anything that was so completely non-human. So it's not exactly a complete answer, but we haven't seen any DNA from anything that doesn't fit quite well with what we know to be human DNA. So, although I know that wasn't the question, if there had been any massive interbreeding with aliens, we would have seen it.
Perhaps so. But there is a lot of discussion about a race of aliens that might have failing DNA. And interestingly enough, what you have told us tonight really is that...
could be us then, couldn't it?
Well, it could be us, yes, couldn't it? Exactly.
And aren't we planning to go to Mars?
That we have failing DNA.
Yes, well.
Just incredible. International Line, you're on the air with Professor Sykes. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Hi. That was funny what you said earlier, Art, about that ETs, or aliens, are all depicted as females. I totally forgot about that, but I was thinking, how do you know they're females and not some other sexual
identity? It just hit me like a brick. I mean, we're talking about grays, and we're intermarrying like crazy, and we're eventually all going to be certain grays or similar in some way, many hundreds of generations down the line if we last that long. And yeah, when you see grays on TV or whatever, they're always female.
That's what I think about. Maybe it's another sex altogether, as in parthenogenesis.
Well,
or completely androgynous. But I had two questions: one about chromosomes and embryos, and the other one about Darwinian theory. So I just wanted to ask your guest, Brian, I wanted to get some clarification on this. If the female chromosome is XX and the male chromosome is XY, wouldn't, in your opinion, make X the standard chromosome and Y the different or the deviant one?
Yep, it does.
That was a yes.
Yeah, okay. That was definitely a yes.
And also...
The Y is a decayed X, no doubt about that.
But also... the male embryo, you were saying, originates as female and then turns into male somewhere down the line. And I guess, wouldn't proof of that be in why males have nipples?
Well, that's sort of a vestigial characteristic. Interestingly, some males can produce milk through their nipples.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. I'd have heard that, too.
And Darwin was known for his theory on survival of the fittest, or survival of the most adaptable, as it were.
Yeah.
So if his theory is true, and Well, how would, wouldn't the longevity of the human male species rely on becoming or becoming more adaptable to the world or environment around him? And what would you, what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, well, not all species manage to adapt, though, so that's the problem, that when the environment changes, some species, and we've seen extinctions, most species become extinct, of course, that it's not necessary that we or any other species will be able to adapt to changes, and the faster they happen, the less likely we are to adapt. Actually, interestingly, the average life expectancy of a species when it starts, when it becomes extinct, is only 100,000 years. So extinctions are happening all the time.
With some rare exceptions, there are some animals that have been around very long.
Oh, of course, yes, but that's the average length of a species, not very long at all.
Professor, as a geneticist, how do you feel about how close we're beginning to get to the ability to manipulate our own genetic makeup, to be our own creators, to be our own God? It almost amounts to that. How does people think of God?
Well, actually, even though I am a geneticist, I'm not in favor of the wholesale interference with our genetic makeup. I, for example, even though I personally wouldn't have much objection to a child born, say, from two mothers, say, a lesbian couple, and sort of sticking my neck out, I think that will happen in my own lifetime. Mm-hmm. I'm not in favor of wholesale genetic manipulation to try and improve individuals' offspring. Certainly not in favor of cloning. I think there's a lot of there's mystery, there's wonder in our genetic variability and our genetic heritage that we've got from our ancestors, and I think it should be, except in the case of very severe diseases, left to its own devices.
But necessarily, as the science for the diseases progresses, the ability to do other things comes with it, doesn't it?
It does, and I think there will be, and we have to be very careful about this, there will be the inclination to try and design your own offspring as being,
yes,
the perfect child, as it were.
Yes.
Great dangers in that, not only from an ethical point of view, which I think are overwhelmingly argue against it, also great dangers because it's very clear that genes do many things. So you might want to alter a gene, for example, to produce a trait which you find attractive in a child, and find that actually it interferes with another gene or another pathway somewhere and gives that child a severe disadvantage. So it's too complicated, it's unethical, and I certainly won't look forward to that day.
The law of unintended consequences.
Absolutely.
It has been said, you know, our time is gone. I mean, that's it. Poof. You were worried about staying awake. Here you are. We're done.
We are.
Yeah, We're done. We're out of time. Your book, did you write this so the average person?
Absolutely. It's not for scientists. It's for everybody. It's written, you don't have to know any science to read it, really.
Well, that's wonderful, and I think a lot of people are going to chase after it. It's called Adam's Curse. The author, my guest, Brian Sykes, that's S-Y-K-E-S. Get to your bookstore, get to Amazon, get to wherever you can get and grab it up. Professor, it has been an honor, truly an honor to have you on.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so, and it's been a great honor and a pleasure for me to be part of it. And as you say, the 3 hours has gone past in a flash.
Good night, Professor.
Good night.
Wasn't that something? Professor Brian Sykes, and once again, Adam's Curse is his book. I think you're going to enjoy it. It was written just for you. But for me, that's it for the weekend. Your regularly scheduled programming resumes tomorrow evening. From the high desert, I'm Art Bell. Good night.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. Magical journey will take take us on a ride, filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight in the desert.